Et on va commencer. Je vais dire quelques mots d'abord pour présenter Emiko Nukitierne. Nous avons le plaisir d'accueillir aujourd'hui pour cette série de deux conférences. Je dois dire que j'ai fait la connaissance du professeur Nukitierne, professeur à l'université de Madison, du Wisconsin à Madison, il y a quelques années. Aux États-Unis, mais je la connaissais par un livre qui avait attiré mon attention lorsqu'il est sorti, et qui est The Monkey as Mirror, qui n'a malheureusement pas été traduit en français, alors que l'un de ses livres va sortir dans quelques semaines chez Hermann, traduit en français, fort heureusement. Alors on ne sait pas si c'est à la fin du mois ou au début du mois prochain. Et ce livre, The Monkey as Mirror, peut-être certains d'entre vous l'ont lu, c'est un livre passionnant parce qu'il prend la figure du singe dans l'histoire et l'ethnologie et les traditions populaires du Japon pour montrer comment, tour à tour, le singe a incarné différents types de figures, positives et négatives, dans l'histoire du Japon. Et j'étais non seulement intéressé par cette façon que Emiko Nukitierne avait d'utiliser un animal pour parler des humains, et suivant cela l'exemple des Japonais, mais j'étais aussi très intéressé par le fait qu'elle avait entrepris au fond quelque chose qui est très difficile à faire et qui est très rare, et qui est une anthropologie globale d'un pays ou d'une culture ou d'un ensemble, d'une nation, d'un ensemble très vaste. Alors que la plupart d'entre nous, les ethnologues, nos unités d'analyse sont beaucoup plus réduites. Et elle a continué à le faire. Alors, juste quelques mots sur sa carrière. Emiko Nukitierne a fait ses études secondaires au Japon, puis elle est allée aux États-Unis pour faire des études supérieures d'anthropologie. Et ses premiers travaux publiés portent sur les Aïnous. Alors c'est une ethnologie qui, au Japon, est classique. C'est un peu l'altérité des Japonais, les Aïnous. Elle a publié sa première monographie dans une collection très réputée, qui est Holt, Reinhardt et Winston, dans laquelle de nombreuses monographies ont été publiées, qui constituent un peu des... Les monographies au moyen desquelles on enseigne l'anthropologie aux États-Unis, donc cette première monographie sur les Aïnous. Puis est venue, parmi les livres que je connais, parce que Emiko Nukitierne a publié une quinzaine de livres, dont un bon tiers au moins en japonais, qui n'ont pas été traduits dans des langues européennes. Et est venu ce livre sur le singe, et puis ensuite un livre qui est du même type, c'est-à-dire qui s'intéresse à la culture japonaise d'une manière générale, vu à travers non plus un animal cette fois-ci, mais une plante, le riz. Comment le riz est en quelque sorte un hologramme qui reflète différentes facettes de la culture japonaise. Je dois dire que j'ai beaucoup appris, n'étant pas un spécialiste du Japon, j'ai beaucoup appris en vous lisant, Emiko. Plus récemment, Emiko Nukitierne s'est intéressé à des livres sur le Japon plus contemporain ou plus récent qui ont été publiés en anglais. Deux d'entre eux, alors j'en ai amené un ici, Kamikaze, Cherry Blossoms and Nationalisms, qui est en fait un peu le thème qu'elle va développer dans cette première conférence et qui est le croisement entre les idéologies nationalistes, totalitaires, en particulier celles qui a caractérisé le Japon pendant une période qui va des années 20 à la fin de la Deuxième Guerre mondiale, et le croisement entre ces idéologies et puis l'utilisation de certains types de symboles, et en particulier des fleurs, et en particulier de la fleur de cerisier. Et ce livre est aussi, comme les précédents que j'ai évoqués, un moyen, à travers une description d'un aspect de la culture japonaise, d'aborder beaucoup plus globalement ce qu'est la culture japonaise. Et je trouve que c'est véritablement un tour de force, parce qu'il y a très peu d'anthropologues qui ont réussi à parler d'une culture aussi vaste et complexe en utilisant des sources historiques et des sources ethnographiques avec un tel talent. Donc je suis très heureux de vous accueillir, Emiko dans cette institution. Et ces deux conférences vont donc aborder deux aspects du travail des Miko au Nuki Tierney. Et le premier, donc, c'est « How do flowers kill communicative opacity in political spaces ?» Et c'est donc cette conférence qui va traiter du rapport entre le symbolisme des fleurs et le malentendu, le misunderstanding, la méconnaissance politique dans l'ignorance que l'on peut avoir des ressorts de sa propre action dans un système totalitaire. Merci d'être parmi nous.
Well, thank you so very much for coming. This is, I realize, the first of the winter term, and I really appreciate your interest and then willingness to come. I would like to thank you very much, Professor Philip Descola, whose scholarship I encountered a couple of years ago or even more. I sat at the Musée Branly on the floor for 2 days gazing at Fabrique de Marge, which was a fabulous exhibit, and then trying to understand what you cannot externalize, objectified, how people do that all over the world. So I did not know him really as well before that, but I truly appreciate his scholarship, which is also very much appreciated in the United States, and he gave a talk to the audience of probably about 500 people at the American Anthropological Association last November. Today's talk is about communicative opacity in political spaces. Communication is of fundamental importance, not only for the survival of a social group, but also for the daily sociality among social animals, including humans. Some hold that communication, especially through human language, defines humanity and places them above non-human animals. The complexity of discursive communication has been pointed out by scholars from Aristotle on. I propose that the discursive and non-discursive symbols offer capabilities for communication, but not necessarily guarantee communication. Furthermore, we have paid less attention to how we are unaware that we do not communicate. Baudelaire and some others, Baudelaire and some others alerted us to this unawareness and pointed out that not only it is ubiquitous, but we are rarely aware of the fact we do not communicate. And so this is the the phrase from which he alerted us to the non-communication. Much later, Pierre Bourdieu used the term méconnaissance, and then he defined it as the institutionalized circle of collective misrecognition in which the habitus of dominant class trickles down. During this process, underclass individuals unconsciously and voluntarily support the domination of the upper class habitus, which is perceived as legitimate and natural. Crucial in his theoretical formulation are invisibility of symbolic power, unitary system of beliefs and values embraced by both those who benefit from the exercise and those who participate in their own subjugation. Third, non-dependence of symbolic power upon the individual's illocutionary power in a given social context. And this particular denial of the power of non-elocutionary power is very often makes especially British and American anthropologists very nervous, because they're much more interested in individual agencies and willingness to analyze at a particular given social context. And this is, I think, a French and Anglo-Saxon Anglo-American anthropology very often has a malentendu, and this rests very much on this point. My interest is to develop their insight first by placing malentendu in political spaces beyond class structure, which Pierre Bourdieu did. In many, it may bring about peace among people, as Baudelaire pointed out, if it takes place in ordinary circumstances. But when it takes place in political spaces, it leaves greater room for the political leaders to misguide their people. Under the authoritarian regimes, using the metaphor of cherry blossoms, the Japanese state told young soldiers to fall like beautiful cherry petals after a short life. In the European authoritarian states, the dictators became the father to whom people, especially women and children, gave roses, a cherished symbol of love deeply embedded in many European cultures. The people hardly articulated in their mind that they were fooled by the propaganda. As examples to show how méconnaissance takes place, rather than obvious political symbols such as the flags, monuments, and pageantries, I am choosing quotidian objects of Japanese cherry blossoms and European roses that have been brought into political spaces. They looked so ordinary to be able to harness political power. Mona Ozouf has shown how French revolutionary symbolism, especially the official symbol of Arbre de la Liberté, the Liberty Tree, derived from the maypole of the folk tradition in many parts of France. The Republican borrowings from popular festivals made the revolutionary symbolism less alien to the popular sensibility. The roses, the traditional symbol of interpersonal love, were deployed by the propaganda machinery of the dictators, especially Stalin and Hitler. But the flower is too quotidian to be threatening to the people, who did not realize the profound change of the meaning and function of the flower under the authoritarian regime. The symbolism of cherry blossoms in Japanese culture has been rich and complex, with a vast set of often seemingly contradictory meanings. And let me turn to the PowerPoint and just give some very sketchy outline of many rich and complex meanings of cherry blossoms. So these are the quotidian symbols that we have been trying to understand. This is the cherry blossom is the spring counterpart of rice, and then deity of mountain descends to the rice paddies on the cherry petals, and then the rice grow under the sun warmth of sun goddess. So it's a very female principle, but it is a pair between rice and cherry blossoms. The cherry blossoms very often is the symbol of warriors, men among men during the traditional times. So this is a very rare woodblock that illustrates how symbolism of cherry blossoms is associated with men. But at the same time, there is an enormously anti-establishment symbolism in cherry blossoms. And so I will, let me show you some of the symbolism of anti-establishment, especially what I call alternative imagination. In the society where the family was very important and the primogeniture was important, reproduction of women was important for the continuation of society, cherry blossoms often were depicted by the masters of woodblock prints in the geisha quarters. Geishas were not prostitutes, but they were by definition non-productive. Non-reproductive members of the society, and it lied outside of a normative world of the Japanese at that time. But this, of course, it's like Hollywood pictures. You know, most of the people had no idea of how they looked like, but every woodblock master depicted cherry blossoms and the geisha quarters. And it became an enormously important source of aesthetic of cherry blossoms and geisha. This is the debut of the very high-ranked geisha. And every spring, they build the bamboo fence and then plant the cherry trees and then invite the customers. It's always at night, so you can see the light from the lanterns of every geisha room. And it is an eerie beauty of night cherry blossoms. This is a famous Utamaro's woodblock print, and there are 45 geisha playing musical instrument, dancing, what have you, under cherry blossoms at night, under moon. The major role of geisha is to entertain, so it was very important for them to play musical instrument and then dance. This is a two apprentices under cherry blossoms with the under the courtesan. And this is, you are not, it's a licensed quarters, and you are not supposed to stay overnight. But sometimes if you make a mistake and comes out in the morning, they cover their face and come to the return to home. It is a culturally practiced activity, but it was legally prohibited to stay overnight. And maybe that's the reason why he's all the woodblocks depict them with the faces covered. The young apprentice for geisha is very bright. This is a very contemporary Kyoto scene under cherry blossoms. And all of these young apprentices and celebrating spring and life. Cherry blossoms also is considered to purify water. So the cherry blossoms, especially when one species was created, it was very easy to transplant. Japan became the land of cherry blossoms, and especially along the rivers and then schoolyards. Let me see. I think I was. Cherry blossoms also has the counter group ritual of cherry blossom viewing. This is not seen, but this is a time of Tale of Genji, and this is a good old time when women are behind the screen, and then men who want to court them must perform their musical ability or poems, and the woman has the right to choose the man. Depends upon this artistic ability. This is the medieval cherry blossoms. And unlike Victor Turner's assertion that rituals are for egalitarianism, time for communitas, you can see that aristocrats are having their own space surrounded by their own curtain with the family crest. And then, so there are a number of spaces for each social group in this. By the Edo, it became very important for every social group to have its own tradition of poems, own tradition of cherry blossom viewing. And this is the merchant class cherry blossom viewing. And you can see how even a monk is participating in this merry dancing under the cherry blossoms. This game. But these cherry blossom viewing by each social group eventually led to the Japanese as a whole. So the cherry blossom became the flower for the Japanese. Of course, at the time when the Western influence, they opened the port, there was a big debate among scholars. Some said cherry blossoms represented feudal Japan, and therefore we should chop down all the cherry trees and replant them with conifer trees so that we can make money. And the others said, no, the foreigners are now coming. We have to have a land of cherry blossom, beautiful land for the foreigners. And the latter survived. And by this time, it was a very turbulent time when two different forces are in operation. One is an enormous rise of patriotism that led to nationalism, cultural nationalism. Adoring cherry blossom became political nationalism as the emblem of the Japanese soldiers' valor to fight. At the same time, there was an enormously important movement for peace, and this is Mrs. Taft of the United States. She went with her husband to Japan and fell in love with cherry blossoms, and then they imported thousands of cherry trees to Washington, and they started the cherry viewing at that time. And it's still every year, the DC has the cherry blossom celebration. Now, the other force that is operating was this national ultra-nationalism. And this is by the Nitobe Inazo. And very interestingly, he was a highly educated man who worked with the League of Nations, so Madame Curie Bergson, Einstein, and all of these for their peace. On the other hand, as he was staying in Philadelphia, he wrote this very nationalistic, and this is the first articulation in a book, how he equated cherry blossoms with the soul of Japan. And he said cherry blossoms and the warrior's way are indigenous to Japan. So it is in a very interesting period of the two forces. And this is the notorious Yasukuni Shrine. And this one, I'm sure you know about it, but was built at the end of the 19th century in order to console the souls of the soldiers who fought on the side of the emperors. But then it became the only shrine governed by, owned and controlled by the military and then the imperial household. And this is a place where the fallen soldier souls are enshrined. And of course, every year, this year, the Prime Minister went to pay a visit, and it was an uproar because there are Asian victims of the Japanese war who also are enshrined. And every time other agents protest that the Prime Minister would visit, which is a national political visit to the shrine. And so the beginning, however, was peaceful. But then this is the five-volume edition of, it used to be the shrine for fallen soldiers. But by this time, 1933 and 1935, it became the shrine for the souls, loyal souls of the emperor. So it became enormously emperor-centered militarism. And I did ask some of the people why the Japanese soldiers, the families who lost their husbands and others, why don't you, how do you feel about being, having your relative buried here? And they said that we have an ambivalent feeling. However, if we are just buried in a remote countryside, then he or she would not be as commemorated. And that's the reason the Japanese remains are not as vocal in the protest as Asian. And then the cherry blossom became an emblem. The upper part is the Navy, and below is the Army. Became very much involved in as a symbol emblem. And this is the cigarette case with cherry blossoms. And then two characters say rising sun. Interestingly, this is a stark difference between Hitler's Germany and Japan. Hitler is the first one who connected cancer with cigarette smoking. So he banned cigarettes and said it's the habit of a degenerate like the gypsies and Egyptians and all that. Whereas in case of Japan, still today, it is owned by the government. And so every soldier received a cigarette with an emperor's crest. I think I don't want to spend too much. And this is the booklet falsifying the Japanese victories given to the families of the soldiers by Tojo. And this is a cherry blossom medal given to the families of the fallen soldiers. And then we go to the what the others say, kamikaze. In fact, it is Shinpu, a special attack force. At the very end of the war, when they realized that there was no other way to bring about the miracle to turn the war against the Americans, because the radar system was getting so sophisticated, no underwater torpedo can go to the to destroy any of the American ships and what have you. They said that only the Japanese soul can bring about miracle. And kamikaze or shinpu, two characters, the characters that were given to the Mongolian at the time of typhoon that attacked, that came to Japan at the time of the Mongolian invasion, which typhoon was able to prevent. So the Japanese has talked about that typhoon as the deity, sacred typhoon. Now, so they thought maybe only that shinpu or the God's wind would bring about the miracle. And then there were 4,000 so-called kamikaze pilots that were killed. There are more and more enlisted. 3,000 were boy pilot like this. They were trained as young boys with a belief that they are more skillful in manipulating the planes. 1,000 of them were graduates of universities, especially the University of Tokyo had the most numbers among these quote-unquote volunteered kamikaze pilots. Well, unfortunately, we do not have the records of the boys, boy pilots, but university students left copious diaries just because that was the only way they could think about the inevitable situation they were placed. And they were not suicide pilots. They tried to understand, why do we have to die at an early age? And so reading, and especially I was going to... educational level at that time is just astounding. So they read the German, French, Italian, Latin, Greek, and all of those, some of them in their original languages. To give only the ones French, they read quite a few numbers of Balzac, Baudelaire, Dumasil, Anatole France, Alphonse Daudet, Jean-Henri Fabre, Emile Faguet, Maupassant, André Mauroy, Blaise Pascal, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, so many, many others. So they were agonizing and trying to find out. And at first I thought that they were trying to find the meaning of their death. But in fact, I started to realize that they are trying to rationalize their death. And they were blasphemously shouting against their military government. So it was not at all voluntary suicide as outsiders have portrayed. But anyway, this is the high school woman who took care of their last days and waving goodbye to the pilots. And this is the so-called kamikaze plane with only one cherry petal on the side. Now, nobody, as far as I know, associated this cherry, one petal, with the death of the soldiers. Amazingly so, I'll come back to that. This is just after the tsunami of March 11th, cherry blossoms again regained a symbol of life, and this is it. Now, so that is what I have for the cherry blossoms, and I would like to go over some on the roses. And this is really audacious on my part, because you know all about roses and I don't. But I'm trying to pick highlights of the roses, and then how the roses too are enormously complex. I don't have the slides for the love is a red, red rose and all this personal simple rose as a personal love. But what very often is not pointed out is that rose has been the symbol of anti-establishment ever since the medieval times. And this is the water cranes symbol. And it is very important the way that May goddess is having the roses with all this what later came out in the mottos of French Revolution is already there. And this is another water crane's and this notion of egalitarianism and liberty and all of that, of course, gave rise to the Socialist International, and for which the Russia was very, USSR was very important. And this is the way the workers are trying to receive roses from the May goddess in Russia. And this, of course, became the logo of the Socialist International. This is a very interesting history of a Russian Jew who broke out of Siberian prison in a sauerkraut barrel, traveled to China, Japan, San Francisco, and to New York, and gave a lecture with an enormous number of people in Yiddish. The workers are primarily Jewish in Brooklyn. But anyway, that's the time this the bread and roses came about. In other words, workers said, we're not satisfied just with bread. We need roses, the operas and the others. Now, this egalitarianism among the workers became very much very useful for the dictators, and especially for Stalin and Hitler. So there are a number of pictures of these dictators given roses and other flowers from children. Women, and as we know, all these dictators wanted to become a father to the people. So it was very important to give the image and how the bond between father and the children is established by the exchange offering of the rose. And there are just numerous pictures like this. This is Hitler on his birthday, and he is receiving roses from children. And it is 1939. And this is the infamous Olympic, Berlin Olympic. And the daughter who is giving a bouquet of roses is the daughter of the one who organized this Olympic as well as the previous one. Very, very different from, I have another chapter comparing Japanese emperor and the dictators, but whereas there was no portraits of Japanese emperors in stamps or coins or any of these things, there's a numerous stamps and other pictures of Hitler. Against Alps in the background, Hitler is given roses from women. And this says, this is the primer of the school text. And the girl and the boy are saying that you are like our father and we love you like our father. So it was very important for them to establish the dictators as father, for which giving of roses was a very important gesture. And so what I would like to read some of my... there was an enormous number of other things I could talk about the individual. So my concluding section is to say, why did Japanese student soldiers, cosmopolitan intellectuals, who read widely in Latin, German, and French, as well as in Japanese and Chinese, and who were liberals or even radicals, fail to notice that the meaning of the flower had changed under the military government? Why was the transformation hardly recognized by anyone else? People at home, soldiers at the front, even scholars of liberal persuasion. A similar question may be posed about roses, which in many cultures in Europe, the Middle East, and elsewhere traditionally stood for interpersonal love. Love is like a red, red rose. And later changed to mean solidarity among workers, as expressed through the emblem of the Socialist International and their slogan of bread and roses. During the authoritarian era in 20th century Europe, the flower became ubiquitous in the propaganda photos of Stalin and Hitler, all of whom received roses from women and children. Each of these dictators sent countless people to their deaths. Did the citizens of the USSR and Germany realize how the rose had been co-opted, as it were, by the dictators to aestheticize their subjugation to the people? I offer three axes for analysis of communicative opacity, which transforms cherry blossoms and roses to be flowers to kill. First, I propose that we make some basic rethinking of what we conceptualize as meaning. Sharedness has been a perennial issue in anthropological debates on culture. If culture consists of polysemic symbols and the plural paradigms, and the culture is historically contingent, there's ample room for communicative opacity to rise in social discourse. I propose that what is public, shared, or collective is not a particular signification in a given context of communication, but the field of meaning, which is quite vast in the case of polysemic symbols. As examples by the Japanese cherry blossoms, often a particular signification in a given context is not shared among social actors who draw different meanings from the common field. Importantly, communicative opacity is rarely recognized. Often people do not articulate exactly which meaning they draw from a polysemic symbol, or question which meaning others read from it. In other words, we don't ask to each other, what meaning did you derive as you're looking at the rose? Communication goes on because they share the field or meaning of a symbol, not because they share the same signification. What is shared is communicative capability with only a potential for communication. Second, although a meaning of a symbol is often thought of in isolation, I propose that every meaning is always defined in relation to other meanings in a given symbol. That is, rather than being discrete entities, each in a pigeonhole, meanings are embedded in social relationships and life processes. The concept of woman is necessarily predicated by men, just as life is a stage of a process leading to death. The normative structure of society or the symbolic system is underscored by its subversion of the anti-self and the anti-structure. However, what are seemingly contradictory or opposite are in fact two ends of the same pole. An important implication of this understanding is that when the symbolic representation shifts its weight and foregrounds, for example, death instead of life, the shift looks natural, and the people fail to realize its magnitude of the change. Thus, the relational and processual nature of each of a large number of meanings of a polysemic symbol, a potential source for communicative opacity. Therefore, in reference to polysemy, the embeddedness in layers of multi-referentiality and inter-referentiality creates a multitude of interrelated concepts. Thesis is embedded in antithesis. However, dynamics of a polysemic symbol do not lie in the static fact of having many meanings, but in the symbol's role in practice, that is, when a given social context, social actors draw different interpretation from a vast set of interlocking and multi-layered meanings, which constitute the semantic field of polysemy. Sometimes all the meanings are present simultaneously, but more often they constitute a palimpsest, with some meanings, such as cherry blossoms, as an agrarian symbol of productivity, no longer dominant, but nonetheless present. Likewise, the rose had represented both the egalitarian and anti-establishment stance ever since medieval times, which Lenin, Stalin, Hitler, and the Soviet Socialist International deployed it for their own purpose. My third axe is the aesthetic. And here I would like to use the term aesthetic as the way people appreciate quotidian aesthetic, rather than aesthetics, which is more the scholarly endeavor to understand the systems of aesthetics in other cultures. Whether Japanese cherry blossoms, European roses, or other markers of the collective self-identity, symbols often assign aesthetic quality. If polysemy creates space for communicative opacity, the aesthetic has even more strong potential for doing so by transforming, for example, the ugly, that is killing and violence, into the sublimity of sacrifice for the nation and other causes greater than oneself. The process of transformation naturalizes all to be sublime. Most helpful for my understanding of aesthetic of symbols in political space is Kant's distinction between the beautiful and sublime. I just skipped all the history of aesthetics. Distinction between the beautiful and sublime, as well as a transference and counter-transference between them. According to Kant, the beautiful in nature is connected with the form of the object, which consists in having definite boundaries. The sublime is to be found in a formless object, so far as in it, or by occasion of it, boundlessness is represented, and yet its totality is also present in thought. He adds, sublimity, therefore, does not reside in anything of nature, but only in our mind. Elsewhere, he explicitly states that it is incorrect to call an object of nature sublime, but correct to call many objects of nature beautiful. Beautiful is that which pleases universally without requiring a concept. There are many problems with Kant's propositions, which, first of all, as Godelier's book, has one chapter, Africa has no flowers. They do not recognize flowers as aesthetic object. And I found the same thing among the Ainu hunter-gatherers in northern Japan. These are the people that I started my career with. And they, for their notion of beautiful is whatever is religious. So one time, I was staying with a woman and in the spring, finally the snow melted and then plants started to come out and we went out to the field and I only spotted flowers. And she, for her, flowers did not exist. She just went to the plants that probably have very good roots for medicine or the leaves that are very good for food or medicine. And so to have distinction of the beautiful nature is not universal. And also, as I just said, that among the Ainu, the whatever is religious is called the pirika. And then that is transferred to that is beautiful. So it is not like Kantian notion of the beautiful is always one directionally transferred into the sublime. And now, of course, this the in Western art, it is very complicated by the but Fabrica de Marge by the scholar points out how the idea of the beauté du quotidien, beauty of the quotidian, emerged during the 17th century in Holland, and then became a major trend in high art during the modern period, and thus entered in aesthetics. However, my focus is on the aesthetics of the folk. And then also I should like to point out, it is the modern time, especially coming out of Paris, when the doubling of the beautiful and the ugly became enormously important in the understanding of aesthetic. The of course, with the rise of modernity, the ugly and the beauty, not just the two sides of the same coin, but they themselves became enormously important in their conceptualization. And of course, the Baudelaire's Fleur de Mal very succinctly expresses this notion. And then Jean Cocteau's La Belle et la Bête, also with a rose as a major symbol, all of those are confronting this problem of the beautiful and ugly. But this is very important when we talk about the real life situation of patriotism. In other words, patriotism has been a beautiful, sublime concept. And that's the reason why cherry blossoms and others in nature that are beautiful are adopted as symbols of national identities and then leads to patriotism and nationalism at the time of war. I think this particular doubling of the aesthetic is when we think about the death. Death can be murder or death of your own. And in fact, the kamikaze pilots who are university students did say, our government is murdering us. It's not they're committing suicide. So we can see how the life situation can also appreciate this doubling of the aesthetics. So the last sentence is the power of communication, communicative opacity is hidden. It plays upon the unawareness of people who are victimized, and its impact may be quite serious. This profound power has the capacity to make changes in the prevailing conceptual structures and, in turn, the society and polity over the course of history, often without involving individuals as social agents. Thank you so very much for your patience. I would like to turn to the questions.